trains. This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. When you tune into Entitled Opinions, you set keel to breakers forth on the godly sea toward some island, archipelago, or continent in the far-flung reaches of intellectual history. Today, however, we're heading home to Ithaca. What does it mean to return to Ithaca? For Odysseus, it meant reclaiming his place in the genealogy of generations. He returned to his father, Laertes, the past, his wife, Penelope, the present, and his son, Telemachus, future. During the years he spent with Circe and Calypso, Odysseus was without these ecstatic coordinates of his human identity. In sum, he was worldless. It didn't matter that Calypso was a shining goddess, or that her island was an earthly paradise. When we're deprived of world and the bounded time that make us human, we long for our homecoming, however mortal its condition may be. Yet the question remains, where is Ithaca, and what exactly does it mean to be at home there? The reason I ask what it means to be at home in Ithaca is because Odysseus's homecoming is not fully achieved once he returns. Remember the visit to the underworld in Book 11 of the Odyssey? There, Odysseus had been told by the prophet Tiresias that once he makes it back to Ithaca, he must take off on yet another journey. With an oar on his shoulder, he must travel to a saltless land where people know nothing of the sea. Says Tiresias, quote, "When another wayfarer, on meeting you, shall say that you have a winnowing fan on your stout shoulder, then you must fix in the earth your shapely oar and make goodly offerings to Poseidon, and death will come to you far from the sea, a death so gentle that it will lay you low when you are overcome with sleek old age." So just when you thought you had returned, you have to take up your oar again and leave. Only this time, your oar is no longer a means of locomotion. It no longer serves the practical purpose it was designed for. The oar now becomes a ritualistic object that you place on your shoulder, carrying it into a place where its instrumentality is misrecognized or misidentified. In that region of unlikeness, far from home, you must plant it in the earth, the ground of your mortality, and thereby come to terms with your death. Only when Odysseus has undertaken this second journey into a foreign land to make peace with his own dying, can he finally return to Ithaca and make himself at home there for the first time. Those who stay at home without undergoing this estrangement are not at home in their own homelands. Let Homer's fable serve as the allegorical introduction to our show today, which deals with Martin Heidegger's Being and Time. This is a book that, in the ponderous prose of German high philosophy, analyzes the kind of being that belongs to Odysseus, insofar as he is resourceful, insofar as he is mortal, insofar as he is human. It is a book that probes the underlying strangeness of the familiar and penetrates the ground in which Odysseus plants his oar, which, by the time he reaches that destination, is neither an oar nor a winnowing fan, but a marker of our being unto death in the mode of anticipatory resolve. Being in Time is a book that undertakes that second journey, dislodging the oar from its familiar context, and following its hero, who goes by the name of Dasein, into that uncanny region where human existence is revealed in its fundamental determinations. With my guest today, we will probe and try to put into relief those fundamental determinations of Dasein's mode of being, as Heidegger understands them, and to share with you our reasons for believing that being in time is one of the most important events in the history of Western philosophy. My guest today is Professor Thomas Sheehan, a wayfarer who has passed through entitled opinions before on two previous occasions. Tom is a professor in the Department of Religious Studies at Stanford and the author of several books, as well as a host of articles on Martin Heidegger. Most recently, he has translated into English Martin Heidegger's 1925-26 lectures on truth, entitled Logic, the Question of Truth. This book, which has just come out with Indiana University Press, is central to Heidegger's overall project of reinterpreting Western thought in terms of time and truth. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Robert.
To start with this new translation that has been published, Logic, the Question of Truth, these lectures were given almost at the same time that Being and Time came out. Certainly, Heidegger probably would have finished with the bulk of the writing. What relation is there between this book that you've translated yourself and Being and Time?
Well, chronologically, it's the last course that Heidegger taught before he took off for his mountain cabin to write Being and Time, and that would have been in March of 1926. So it's the last course before that. And it's also significant that in the middle of this course, the dean of the philosophy faculty approached Heidegger and said, "You must publish something now." Well, as it turns out, Heidegger had a bunch of courses. This was one of them that he could put together into what became eventually Being in Time, the most important book that he published, really, in his lifetime, and a real classic, of course.
So this Logic is a first draft of Being in Time, in a sense?
It's a first draft of parts of Being in Time. He had already worked out other parts in the courses in the 20s before this. But Logic, the Question of Truth, it's a difficult book, especially in its latter and in his last third, where he deals with Kant, but a very rewarding one. I would say that it's divided into three sections. One is Heidegger's very close reading of psychologism and his critique of that.
What is psychologism, Tom?
Psychologism is the reduction of all the rules of logic to just the workings of the mind. So that if we could anthropologically study what the mind is doing when it thinks, we would have all of the laws of logic. So that they're no longer universal. They're no longer free of human reasoning. They are simply dependent upon human reasoning itself. So his critique of that. And then in its second part, a very fruitful part, I think, you have an analysis of logos. That's the word that underlies logic, the question of truth. An analysis of logos as the human being's a priori need to make sense of things. Logos is not language. It's not binding things together. It's making sense, as Heidegger makes clear. And also in that second part, his best analysis of meaning by reference, that is, say, aletheia itself, by reference to Aristotle's metaphysics book, Theta, chapter 10. So we've got psychologism, we've got logos and aletheia, and then thirdly, and stunningly good, I think, is his best statement of what he means by time. And he defines time as the need to make things meaningfully present. So he focuses on the present moment of time. Anyway, he does this by a close and, I must say, difficult analysis of Kant and schematism, which turned out to be the first draft of his 1929 book on Kant. And in the whole book, he anticipates what he would later say, namely that time is only a stand-in for aletheia, whatever this Greek word means, incorrectly translated as truth. So it's an important text. It underlies a certain shift that's taking place in the profession these days. I would call it a paradigm shift that's settling in among the younger scholars, among the best graduate students, as well as among some of us oldies, and where the paradigm shift consisting in, and it's clear from part two of this book, that Heidegger interprets being as meaning, Bedeutsamkeit, as he calls it, Bedeutung or Sinn. So meaning, significance, etc., is what he means by being, which is no surprise because being is always the meaningful presence of something to one in the practical or the theoretical order. So the emphasis on being as meaning is, I think, crucial to the text.
We can talk about how philosophy is these days going back to this determination. But first, on psychologism, when he, that first part of logic, when he's dealing with psychologism, he's taking up, I presume, Husserl's own polemic against psychologism, that in a certain sense, his phenomenology is not that it's predicated on the critique of psychologism, but the critique of psychologism in Husserl's phenomenology was crucial. How do you understand Heidegger's relationship to Husserlian phenomenology in Being and Time now?
Yeah, that's a big and very, very important topic. And I think that part of the shift of emphasis these days has been the rediscovery of phenomenology as the very basis of Heidegger's work, Being and Time and all the rest. He said in 1969, shortly before he died, that his work was phenomenological through and through. Both phenomenological and hermeneutic, so perhaps we have to say something about both of those. In the early 70s, about 5 years before he died, I had the opportunity to meet with Heidegger in his home in Freiburg for a long conversation one afternoon in April of 1971. And the topic that we mostly discussed, we discussed phenomenology and Aristotle, phenomenology, comma, and Aristotle, two separate topics. But it was phenomenology that he put his emphasis on, and he made it utterly clear to me, I was just a young PhD at the time, that there is no understanding Heidegger without understanding phenomenology. And he walked me through some of the sections of logical investigations on sensual and categorial intuition.
That's Husserl's main opus.
Husserl's main book, the first volume of which was Husserl's Critique of Psychologism, as you mentioned. And he emphasized that phenomenology is not about things out there. That's what he calls ousia, stuff that is. But phenomenology, rather, is about the meaning of things in our world of use, of practical orientation, the significance of things. It's precisely meaning that changes things out there into phenomena, that is to say, things that meaningfully appear to us and that we can engage with. So, as he made clear, phenomenology is exclusively about meaning, sense, significance, what Heidegger calls Anwesenheit, a German word that means presence to you in a meaningful way. So he was never about things out there now as they're real and so on. He was always about their interface, their correlation with human being, and human beings' correlation with meaning. So phenomenology is the search for the last word on meaning. But Heidegger, as you know, always uses the word being. Except in his later years, he sort of came out and said, and I quote, "I no longer use the word being gladly or gern." I no longer like to use the word being would be the way to translate it. He said in his later writings that being was only a preliminary word. He said that basically being was to be surpassed into the phenomenological correlation, which he called Ereignis in his own interpretation. So I would say, with citing Woody Allen, that being is just another way of saying meaning.
Yeah. Can I take issue with that? Not issue, disagreement philosophically, but the heavy emphasis you put on the word meaning, and I know your work and your interpretation of Heidegger's corpus as a whole, that by privileging that one word, you gave a number of other possible words. You said interface, correlation. You said the way things appear to human, the sense that they have. When we use the word meaning, there are connotations to that, that there is something humanly dependent on meaningfulness, and that the meaningfulness can reach an order of having a larger meaning to life, for example. Why not just stick at, for the moment, when we're talking about phenomenology, with the fact that things appear to us in ways that are accessible? That can be in the realm of visibility. It can be in the realm of intelligibility. It can be in the realm of practicality, the practical use, or any number of modes. And I think that the word meaning doesn't encompass the full array of possibilities of how things are given over to us in, as phenomena.
Well, except that Heidegger insisted in Being and Time on the word Bedeutsamkeit, which means meaningfulness. The first name for being in Heidegger's work is world, the meaning-giving context, as he calls it, the Bedeutsamkeit. So he did not shy away from discussing being in terms of meaning, Anwesenheit, presence to, accessibility, as you say. But he does use the word Bedeutsamkeit, Bedeutung, all through his analysis of world in Being and Time. And he makes it clear that the central, how shall we say, determination of human being, of Dasein, is being in the world, being in meaning, in Bedeutsamkeit. So
is that what, so is world reducible to the meaning?
Yes. I mean, he actually defines world as the structure of world is Bedeutsamkeit. What goes on inside of world is Bedeutung. As he says, when things are discovered along with human being, that is to say, when they've been understood, we say they have meaning. They have Sinn, Bedeutung. In this case, it's Sinn, the word he uses. So really what he's saying is that the human being is a hermeneut. That's not an add-on to some sort of plain old existence. Our existence is the obligation, the need, the thrownness into making sense of things. In fact, the first meaning of the word aletheia is meaning. It's not truth, yeah, you know, as Heidegger points out. So if we're embedded in hermeneutics, if he is using the word Bedeutsamkeit, I think that we can actually retrieve from this plain old common white bread word being, we can retrieve the urgency that Heidegger feels, that things are in your face. He says in one point in his first course after the war, Great War, in February of 1919, he asks his students, what is it that you first encounter in your lived world? Is it things? Is it objects? Is it beings? No, he says. It's das Bedeutsame, the meaningful. He says that's what's in your face all over the place. It's coming at you. So we don't want to lose him to traditional ontology, which just talks about the inner substance of things, as our colleague Gumbrecht says. No, we want to have him on this side of phenomenology, as he himself insisted. And one way of constantly recognizing that is to say that being is being in your face. Being is meaning.
Well, okay, we're not going to resolve that only because of the connotations of the word meaning associated for me very much with analytic philosophy, which is an analysis of meaning-making in propositions, and that the meaning-making activity is one that is very cerebral. It seems to be related back to subjectivity. The great excitement of Being and Time is that it was such an existentialist sort of treatise, and he didn't call it being and meaning, he called it being and time. And time is something which would you agree that it would be the kind of ground of meaning as you're referring to it? And if so, there's a way in which being temporal includes all sorts of things that don't enter into the usual connotation of the word meaning, namely thrownness into the world and being ahead of oneself and self-transcendence and being unto death and all these great existential categories that seem to take us away from this otherwise cerebral activity of making sense of everything.
Right. Well, there's a lot in what you said there, a number of questions and implicit questions in what you said. So maybe we should start by asking why he even called his main work Being and Time. And that's where the 1925-6 course, Logic, the Question of Truth, comes in, because the whole last third of it, through an analysis of the schematism, is an effort to give a statement on what he means by time. And it's clear throughout Heidegger's work that the source of his meditations on temporality are not Aristotle. It's not the time of the cosmos. It's not the spread of moments across a certain arc. Rather, his focus in understanding time is Augustine and Plotinus. In other words, time is a characteristic of human existence. So it takes it out of the cosmos and precisely puts it into the realm of human existence. So time occurs only with the human being. Both Aristotle and Augustine and Plotinus would agree with that. But time occurs only with the human being. It's a basic characteristic of the human being. And time, he says this in 1949. He says this in the logic book that I translated. Time is only a preliminary way of saying aletheia, openness, unclosedness, disclosure, which is something that is the primary determinant of human being. It's the existential that determines human being, which is that we're constantly embedded in the meaning-making process, which is not a subject's sort of casting of meaning over things. It's rather an interplay, a correlation between meaning and man. When I use man, of course, I use it in the generic sense, not male-female sense. I'm using it as translating anthropos in Greek, human being. So his motto in Being in Time is, without being, no Dasein, ohne sein kein Dasein. But what he's really talking about is the interface of human being and meaning, ohne Sinn kein Dasein. Without Dasein, there is no place for meaning to occur. This is clear throughout the text, that what time temporality means is being present to things, not passively, just receiving them, but actively making sense of them. That's not simply painting them a certain color, because we're always already involved with, familiar with, engaged with meaning as such.
Being in time is in two parts. So in the first part, there's a distinction between Dasein in its inauthentic modes of being, and then in the second division, you know, the authentic mode of being of Dasein. And I presume that meaning making pertains to both modes.
Sure.
But if I can ask you the meaning of some fundamental terms that he uses in part one, especially, because he says that Dasein, that there are three particular modes of being of Dasein: facticity, existentiality, and fallenness. Can you very briefly go through what these three determinations of Dasein amount to, starting with facticity?
Right. He gives different names to the triads. One would be thrownness, projectedness, and being meaningfully present to, sein bei. So what if we take it in, first of all, take facticity in the sense of one's thrownness? As you and your audience knows, his way of denominating the determinations of human being, the a priori determinations, is to call them existential characteristics or existentials, just like that. And the most basic existential of them all is Dasein's thrownness. All the others derive from it, even Dasein's alethic function of making sense of things. So the basic existential characteristic is called thrownness. Eventually it will be called facticity. But thrownness into what? He says thrownness into the world of Bedeutsamkeit, the world of making sense. And what he means from the very first page of Being in Time is you have to be yourself. The question becomes, what is this self? This self is hermeneutical. The self is intrinsically sense-making. So I have to be a hermeneus. I have to make sense of things is the first characteristic of human being.
So when thrownness is a being thrown into a world without my having chosen to be in the world, and it's I'm thrown as also projected beyond myself. Is that the dimension of existentiality, or the you're thrown in so far as you're thrown with a past, but also you're out ahead of yourself, reaching out into your future.
Into a future, sure.
And then you are also then present among other people as well as things, and you're kind of fallen in and among things in a way that you might be making sense of them, but in a fallen mode by just using them instrumentally. And how does this projection, how does projection relate to thrownness?
Right. The human being is divided against itself, or is disjunctive in relation to itself. It's not all self-contained. It's not closed in upon itself like the Aristotelian god who thinks of nothing but itself, right? The self-thinking thought, as we sometimes translate it. So what we're thrown into, rather, is our openness. I sometimes like to put the two terms, thrownness and projection, facticity and existentiality, put them together as thrown openness. Openness referring to one's alethic function of making sense of things. But openness really means the opposite of the Greek closure. So it's a sign of finitude, of fragility, of the need to strive, hence a future, etc. And the disjunction that we're thrown into is that we cannot take things immediately and understand what their meaning is, their significance, their being, if you want to use that term. Rather, we always have to take them in terms of something else. It's a discursive, a step-by-step kind of knowledge, unlike, we'll say, the knowledge of God, where God just opens his eyes, if I could put it that way, and understands exactly what the thing is. No, we have the labor of the concept in Hegel's sense. We have to work in order to put together this in terms of that. And that is the dimension of meaning of this particular object. I'm holding a cup in my hand here. It could be used to contain water, this in terms of water container. It can be used as a missile to throw at somebody, this in terms of weapon. It could be used as a paperweight, for example, this in terms of holding down paper. So that disjunction at the core of human sense-making is what will eventually be called temporality, human openness as such. But when we're thrown into projectiveness, we're thrown into the need to reach ahead, as it were, and into the meaning of something in order to understand it for what it is.
Well, Tom, can I ask about fallenness? Because we're almost speaking about Dasein in its authentic mode, or something that's not necessarily related to its inauthenticity. But Heidegger makes it clear time and again that, for the most part, Dasein exists inauthentically, in a state of fallenness. What does he mean by that?
Okay. If I could take one step back, because you refer to being with other people, things, ourselves even, sein by, che in French, da in Italian, I'm with things. It's always important to remember that the issue of being with is not simply a physical coming up against, but rather a relationship of meaningfulness in relation to things, to people, to myself, etc. Heidegger bifurcates sein by, being with things meaningfully, into two forms, into two modes, we might say. One is inauthentic and one is authentic. And the principle of difference between that is whether or not one relates to things in terms of one's full human nature, or if one instead treats oneself and other things, other people, as just out there, as to be kind of bumped up against. That would be an inauthentic way, because one's not reflecting upon or bringing to bear one's whole human nature, finite, mortal, and all of that. So authentic, actually, the Greek word authentic, authentikos, means the one who commits the murder, believe it or not, the one who's responsible for the murder. So to be responsible for one's whole human nature is to be authentic. That is to say, to have accepted oneself as thrown, as disjunctive, as finite, as going to die.
Yeah.
So inauthentic is all the opposite of that.
I used to be much more fascinated by the authenticity side of the two because I thought that's where it all happened. Now I have to say that his analysis of inauthenticity interests me a lot more than his analysis of authenticity because, to begin with, we are authentic only in privileged moments,
right,
where we have these moments that break us out of the continuum. But for the most part, our home, where we live, where we are in Ithaca, as it were, is in the inauthentic world. Now, of course, in my little allegorical introduction, I said that Odysseus, if he's really going to make himself at home, he's going to have to estrange himself within the familiar, and he's going to have to undertake this journey into the strange land, and his oar will no longer be this instrument that he uses in an everyday functionality mode, but it becomes something that becomes a marker for his own death and his own mortality. So it's a thing of authenticity, but after that, he can go back to Ithaca and actually make himself at home in a kind of world that is now not just the place where he's from, but he's taken full possession. He's repossessed that world of his. Now, inauthenticity, the reason I'm very intrigued by it, especially these days, is because I think it's become so much more of an inevitable reality in our own world than it was even when Heidegger was writing, bemoaning mass society and the Das Man and so forth. He speaks about three different determinations for inauthenticity. Idle chatter. He calls it idle curiosity, gossip, and is it diversion or entertainment? There's something along these lines. It's like the perfect age of the internet where you have a thing which is completely open to idle curiosity. And here I actually am persuaded by something that Bert Dreyfuss said once at a conference here at Stanford, that the internet and the idle curiosity, that it, what it does not allow for is an infinite passion. Or that's Kierkegaard's term, by the way, an infinite passion. Or we could call it an unconditional commitment. But Heidegger seemed to be prescient when he said that idle curiosity is one motive, dominant motive in authenticity. Gossip or the desire to know what your neighbor is doing and up to is the other. And then entertainment. Is it entertainment or diversion? I don't know what the third one is. But
well, that raises that's a very good point, and Bert Dreyfuss's reference of the internet, I think, is very well done, and it could lead us, if we wanted to Heidegger's effort to pierce through that fallenness and that that sense of immediacy that we get from the internet, and the answer, the name rather, of that piercing through. The experience of being estranged from that kind of estrangement of oneself is called dread.
Mm-hmm.
And he intimates, he has a small section of that in Being in Time, and then he has a much longer and discursive treatment of it in the wonderful essay called What is Metaphysics, 2 years after Being in Time. Phenomenology, by the way, besides being about meaning and significance, is always about first-person experience of that. So it really puts the burden on the one responsible for oneself, right?
Yes.
Namely me, I. So he walks us through this wonderfully worked out phenomenological analysis, which he's inviting us to experience, of having your whole world, everything that gives meaning to you, fall apart. It's not just that a particular thing no longer makes sense, but it would be as if the internet crashed and all of a sudden you have nothing to do. You have nothing but your own idleness and your insignificance. What Heidegger describes dread as is the experience of the whole world filled with its meanings that we're familiar with and we forget about ourselves as we move through this world. What if it were suddenly to collapse? Sartre writes this up, of course, novelistically in Nausea, La Nausée, where he describes Roquentin's experience of his whole world collapsing. Heidegger does it briefly, more succinctly, and philosophically. When your whole world collapses, you realize that you are so much a hermeneute, a maker of sense, but so finitely a maker of sense that sooner or later this is going to die. It's an anticipation of one's death, the experience of dread is, because there is an alternative to making sense, and that is to be dead. So in the experience of dread, you move right to that frontier between nothingness, absurdity, your own death, and making sense. And Heidegger says the experience is not one that pulls you into your death or encourages you to commit suicide or to fall into nothingness. He actually says that the experience of dread, of that thin line that separates you from nothingness, that what I would call being ever at the point of death, throws you back. The word he uses is abweisen. It directs you back into the sense-making world. Now with the awareness that there is no ground under your feet, you're doing this on your own. You alone are le responsable, the person who's responsible for it. Tu are the responsable. And that's what he means also by the call of conscience. The experience of dread, the call of conscience are two different ways of talking about experiencing the internet, the world of meaning, crashing, and finding out that I am alone. I am dreadfully alone in the midst of all of this. Do I have the courage to accept that in an act of decision or resolve, to accept that that's what all of meaning is about, that I'm bound into a correlation that will finally just disappear when I die?
Well, again, one could say that the risk one takes by emphasizing so heavily on the word meaning is that it creates a difficulty to understand this moment of awakening through the experience of angst or dread, where I realize that all my meaning-making activity is fundamentally meaningless or absurd, and that meaninglessness is the ground for the possibility of meaning, and therefore being has to mean more than meaning. It has to mean my being at that edge of my finitude where everything slips into a kind of nothingness, and I realize that I am the nullity of all my projects, and meaning-making is a highly circumscribed activity, and it does not exhaust the potentiality of my being.
Well, I would disagree, and I'm only trying to explain, not convince, explain why some of us see this a different way. Heidegger says in the 1925-26 course that human beings are embedded in meaning. It's huis clos. There is no way out of this one. There is no exit from that. Making sense of one's own life, that's what it means by being, having to be, having to. It doesn't mean just having to tick-tock, tick-tock your way through life. It means actually to, is there any meaning in my life? It's true what you said, as far as I can see, that the real source of all meaning-making is absurdity, it's death. We're constantly pushing back that moment, or it's pushing us back into sense, and that's our experience. But the moment of dread, like the moment of conscience, the call of conscience, the moment of dread is experiencing yourself as right at the point of death. I don't like the phrase being towards death, as if we're going down a road and someday at the end the road will end. No, it's about right here and now. Zum in German can mean right here and now at your death. And that death is the realm of absurdity, because there will be no more sense to your life. There will be no more life. But I don't see, this hermeneutical side as an add-on to existence. It is rather the definition of existing. It's what makes human beings different. The human being is the animal that has logos, that is possessed by logos, which is making sense.
Well, again, can I ask, can I put it in another way?
Please.
You're bringing up angst and the role that angst plays in authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
Angst, he describes as an emotion or a mood, and one of the original contributions, as I see it in Being and Time, in the history of philosophy, is that Heidegger actually proposes what we might call a philosophy of moods, or he retrieves things like state of mind and mood and the emotional life as legitimate grounds for philosophical sense-making. So that, in what... I can go along with you that moods are always meaningful, but there's something in the fact of moods which seems to escape the ordinary understanding of meaning as something that we can reduce to conceptualization. So that's why so what do you make of Heidegger's redemption of mood as a philosophical opening?
Right. Both earlier and just now, you seem to look upon meaning as what you say analytic philosophers deal with, or as you put it now, meaning reducible to conceptuality. Well, that's not exactly what Heidegger means by meaning. By meaning, he means making your way, unterwegs sein, being on a way, a path, where things open up and give you a world where that you can live in, that you can be familiar with, rather than anything like a conceptuality. He doesn't mean that at all by meaning, because he's not talking about it in a, we would say, an ontic sense of, you know, the mind that is generated by your brain, as it were. You know, no, for him, it is a way of being. It's a way of being on your way, opening up a territory of meaning. But back to mood, mood is for him a Stimmung, which means a resonance. It's like two tuning forks. If you hit one, the other will start to resonate with it. So it's a familiarity with meaning where both of them are resonating, both are on the same terms, as it were. I would call that correlation between these two resonating somethings, I would call that what Heidegger calls Ereignis. It's the correlation whereby man needs meaning and can't exist without it. That would be the first part of Being in Time, the unpublished part being meaning needs man. Meaning appears only with Dasein in various configurations. So that this resonance between the two, he even uses a German word that says that, the word Gegenschwung, which means to go back and forth, resonate back and forth. That's the core of thrownness into meaning, is that we can't separate ourselves from that buzz, as it were, which gives us our meaning, our being, and makes meaning able to appear. If you consider, if I may, with the question of being, I once asked a friend of mine who was holding a position similar to yours, I asked him, when the meteorite hits and we're all dead, will there still be being? And he answered, well, of course there will be. There will be the moon, the sky, the earth itself. We won't be there, but there will be things in existence.
I would say no, though.
I would say no. Of course we would say no, because being is only in correlation with human being. So now we've moved entirely away from the tradition of being as being out there, and out there now real, as Lonergan puts it. Rather, it's the importance of this to me, this thing that I'm holding to me, that is what being is. It's my, I use the phrase, in my face. I can't escape that relationality. And mood is the primary way in which we feel the significance of this. When I raise a cup to my lip to drink some water, I don't even have to conceptualize anything. I simply know how to do it. And that would be the primary instantiation of Stimmung, namely that I'm in resonance with that world of meaning. So that's what I'm thrown into. I'm thrown into a mood, which is a relationship to a whole world of meaning-giving relationships that surround me. And that's going to be gone, as you say. There will be no being when there's no Dasein. There will be no meaning when there's no Dasein.
Well, in fact, Heidegger says in Being and Time that the laws of Newton were not true prior to Newton's discovery of them. They did not, in a certain sense, did not have their being. It's only in their uncovering that they come into play. Do you think that Dasein's temporal constitution, mm-hmm, that makes it always ahead of itself and gives it a certain anticipatory access to its own death, which it means more than just demise, but means a certain kind of nullity that is always operative in my experience of being in time. That this is what discloses for the first time the intelligible world that gives us access to things.
Yes, I do. I think you said that very well. And in being in time, as you know, there's a step-by-step, as it were, reduction to the basis of everything. So you have being in the world in the first part of being in time. That gets defined as concern for meaning, sorge, besorgen, fürsorge, right? So from being in the world to care, as it sometimes is translated, to temporality, ultimately, as the meaning of care and of being in the world. So that temporality, that anticipation of death, is the core of meaning. It is the ultimate source of meaning, one might say. But I like to look at that word anticipation for a moment, because as we have discussed many times, I think that the down the road, up ahead death is the wrong way to look upon being unto death. The anticipation means to grab ahead of time. So before I die, I can actually understand and be attuned to my mortality. And that's what the moment of dread is about. That's what the call of conscience is about. Conscience, the call of one's own nature, as it were, conscience says to you in German, schuldig. Now, it's usually translated as guilty. You're guilty for whatever. But another translation of a schuldig is responsible for. You're responsible for your nothingness, your nullity, as you put it earlier. You know, you are in the driver's seat when you confront this experience. What are you going to do with it? You can run from it. You can pretend it's not there. You can be proof rock. You can just say, no, I'm not up for that. Or you can embrace it, understand it, and say, even if only in momentary experiences, as you point out, authentic experiences where we lift our face out of the mud and realize what we are, even if only in renewable moments, that is the basis on which I'm going to live my life. That would be the act of what he calls resolve, Entschluss. By anticipating one's death, by understanding one's mortality, death is death, after which there's nada. But to anticipate it is to really feel, resonate with the mortality that you are, with the utter finitude of what you are. Now, Heidegger, of course, stops there. We won't go into the discussion of how he learned to apply this or didn't apply this in his own decisions, etc. But at least he sets up that model for being a human being on the basis of which everything else can be built. That's why he calls it a fundamental ontology. It would be the basis for an ethics or an aesthetics or anything after that.
So we have a cluster of terms, angst, the call of conscience, and guilt, and they're all intimately interrelated. Angst is something that has an awakening. It awakens me to the fact that there's not a stable foundation. There's not a positive foundation to existence, but there's rather a nothingness and das Nicht, the no thing rather than a thing. The call of conscience is one that comes, if I heed the call of conscience, its whence is also the whither, Heidegger says. It's coming to me from where I will be going, namely this finitude that I am. And it calls me, it awakens me also to my guilt in the German sense of debt, as not just sinfulness, but the sense that I owe something, I'm in obligation. And do you believe that Dasein can ever discharge that debt, or is the most we can do when we resolve authentically on who we are, that we can just acknowledge that this is a debt that is undischargeable in full awareness?
Right, and I would say a responsibility that even when you choose not to notice and not to live with is nonetheless your responsibility. To choose to not be responsible is still to be responsible, still to be in debt, as you have put it. So I would think that's the case indeed.
And Tom, can I ask just a follow-up question? Because the interesting thing there in being in time is after he's talked about anticipatory resolve, he goes away from the individualistic emphasis of Dasein, and he starts speaking about the fact that Dasein is also an heir to a tradition, and that through the moment of authenticity, you can authentically retrieve possibilities in your heritage and renew them or recast them and reappropriate them in an authentic mode. And then you become not just a temporal being, but you become an authentically historical agent.
Right.
And you belong not only to yourself, but now you belong also to your tribe, your community, your nation, your species, and so forth. That is a very important move, I think, towards the end of Being in Time, that perhaps could have been further developed, but was not.
Right. Some, of course, would accuse him of developing it in a nefarious direction,
right,
saying that the community is Germany and all of that. The way that that retrieval takes place that you're describing, where one goes into one's corporate past, one's individual past, it all depends what you're retrieving, and brings it into something explosive, useful, futural, is by, as he says, passing it under the eyes of death, a dramatic phrase, you know, going into the teeth of death is another way that he says. In other words, take all of those possibilities that are yours, that are on your shoulder, and choose among them which you want to live with in the light of your mortality, passing it under the eyes of death, as it were. And there's lots of things in our past that we would prefer to just let go, and rightly so. But if we're able to take possibilities and renew them in a finite mortal way, that would give one a sense of one's historicness, one's connection with the past, and one's ability to renew that in a future that is a mortal, finite future.
But you would agree that there is no ethical prescriptions possible, even when one embraces resolutely, you know, your own mortality. It does not provide standards for making choices that are right rather than wrong, which is troubling to a lot of moral philosophers when they look to Heidegger and say, well, on the one hand, he's suggesting that there is a way of making authentic decisions in an authentic mode, but he will not tell us what kinds of things would be right and wrong to choose.
Right.
It's up to you to choose.
And I think that failure to provide any kind of standards that would, as it were, channel the passionate authenticity that he calls one to. He, in section 74, he says, give up shirking your duty, give up being lazy. You know, he has three or four categories there. But the fact that he couldn't work out some sort of ethics, even at a meta level, is probably the fault or the weakness of his philosophy, insofar as it can't take the next step, it can't even begin to take the next step, and it put up no bulwarks for him himself in his choices in the future. So, yeah, I do think that really with Heidegger, you do need a complement. I wouldn't, well, some people would say a Levinasian compliment. I would look to more Enlightenment compliments to that, a sense of equality of people and so on, rather
but
than...
But do you believe, like some people believe, that if a philosopher can make the kind of mistakes that Heidegger made after he wrote Being in Time, that it goes a long way in neutralizing the validity of the philosophy itself? I mean, it's really actually quite astonishing that someone who could author Being in Time and be the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, one of the greatest philosophers in the Western tradition, would have such a colossal failure of judgment when it came to historical events that he was embroiled with.
Right. I remember the first day I arrived in Freiburg in an attempt to visit with Heidegger. I had to wait for another year to visit him. I had a letter of introduction, but he was ill. I met a former professor of mine who lived in Freiburg, and he said to me, I will have nothing to do with someone who has been a Nazi. I figured, wow, that was the first time I'd been confronted with that, because the American story put forth by Hannah Arendt was, no, that was just a passing mistake, a kind of a an adventure on his part. It is utterly astonishing to me that he could write such a brilliant text, calling one to responsibility, and then find himself not only in the political order, but as we now know through the letters to his wife, in his own personal life, to be a man who was entirely irresponsible vis-a-vis other people, not to mention his sense of German nationalism and what that led to. On the other hand, we do have this text that is written prior to his work. We have plenty of texts written after his sympathy for Nazism waned in the later 30s. But we do, as Immanuel Fay has pointed out in his very flawed book, Heidegger, The Introduction of Nazism into Philosophy, a very flawed text, we do have, he has discovered texts that show Heidegger to have basically been a minion, sort of the useful idiot of Hitler and Nazism. And it's just absolutely shocking. And he even later on tries to locate it in 1936. He tries to say, my whole notion of historicity is what led me in this direction. Well, Herbert Marcuse read Being and Time and said, on the contrary, it leads in the direction of sociality and a community of authentic human beings. Yeah. So, you know, the doctors are divided, doctores skinduntur, but we still have the paradox of a brilliant set of texts and a flawed man.
Do you think a lot of his subsequent thinking, his so-called later thinking, is a rethinking of the role that responsibility plays and what philosophy's role is in assuming responsibility? For example, the letter on humanism, which he writes right after the end of the war, it's all about the relationship between thought and action, and he's making it very clear there that he thinks that thought is responsible to itself only as a form of thinking, not as something that can translate into action as we understand it politically and socially. And there we get a very different sort of, not a contrite Heidegger per se, but a chastened one who now has despaired of philosophy's relevance to the larger world.
I find his repentance, if we can even call it that, because he was very chary about putting forth any apologies at all. But in his private correspondence with Jaspers, for example, he points out that he was utterly devastated by his own guilt over this thing. He was so ashamed, as he puts it. But I must say that in the later writings, I don't find him coming to grips with his Nazi period at all. Rather, he comes to grips, and meaningfully so, with something like the spread of fallenness throughout civilization and culture in the form of technology and so on. But personally, I don't feel that he ever stepped up and took responsibility for the 30s.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that. But at the same time, if the 20th century did tell us something about philosophy's fecklessness, even when it becomes ethical philosophy or prescriptive philosophy, it's fecklessness to really intervene in a decisive way into the course of history. And perhaps there's something there about Heidegger's realization that thinking has to take care of itself and hope that in mysterious ways the relationship between thinking and action will work itself out in ways that we perhaps cannot even suspect being operative. But it's not going to be an immediate sort of connection.
Going back to phenomenology, there's the failure of phenomenology in Heidegger, I would think. Phenomenology is about first-person experience, taking things concretely, and Heidegger got more and more abstract as he moved back into the Greeks, etc., and favored writing about poetry. Yeah. And so it was sort of like a retreat from not the abstract, but the concreteness that phenomenology wants to be about.
Yeah, that's why I like to go back to the early stuff in the phenomenology.
Yeah, it's really alive there. As Hannah Arendt says, it was thought came alive,
yes,
again.
Yes, you know? Passionate thinking, indeed.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with Professor Thomas Sheehan from the Department of Religious Studies on Entitled Opinions about Martin Heidegger. If you would like to access our other shows, please just log on to the website of the Department of French and Italian at Stanford and click on Entitled Opinions. You can get almost about 100 shows now, believe it or not, Tom. It's been about 70 shows between the last time you were on and now.
Congratulations.
They're all available either on iTunes or on our webpage. So thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
And we'll be with you next week.
Bring out your dad. Bring out your dead. 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 Bring out your dead.
The snake, he's long.